We're starting a new series called God's Name, the Name of God series. What's in a name? What's in a name? It's something to distinguish an individual by. I heard of an Asian family who I guess they knew that they were going to have a bunch of kids. And so firstborn was called number one. Secondborn was number two. Thirdborn, number three. So on and so forth down the road up until number 14. Easier to go, hey, number three, come here, fetch this. Number four, go do that, right? It's something to distinguish a person by. When we had our girls, Senna and Sari, and they're pretty unique names, I toiled long and hard to come up with those names. We wanted to make sure that they were both English-sounding and Korean-sounding because there are so many Asian Americans like myself who have both Korean name and English name, and so they flip-flop, and you know they get confused, and people that they're giving their names to get confused, or worse, they don't have an English name, and so it's almost impossible to pronounce. You know, just like myself, I hate it whenever they ask me, so what's your name? And I go, Seung-yol. And then they go, come again? Seung-yol. Oh, Soo-young? No, Seung-yol. Oh, Soo-young, nice to meet you. I'm like, forget it, you know, close enough. Let's go with that. And so to avoid all of that trouble, we wanted to make sure that our girls' names sounded somewhat like Senna, you know, like Senna, Sarah. That sounds like, okay, we know that most English-speaking people can say that name, and Sari, too. So let's stick with that. And they sound Korean as well, you know, unless you knew Korean, you would know that, but we wanted to make sure. But it's mostly what we designate them by. We wanted them to be unique, and of course they have some meaning associated with it, but name is a name. However, when it comes to the Bible, name means so much more. There's meaning associated with the name, and not only that, but also a lot of times it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. What you are named and what it means, you become it. For example, Abraham, it means a father of a multitude. And that's exactly what Abraham became. God gave him that name or changed his name from Abram to Abraham. You are going to be a father of many nations, and that's exactly what he became. So three largest world religions, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, consider Abraham their father. Right? And exactly what his name says he became. Jesus, what does his name mean? In the Old Testament, it's the same name as Joshua. In the New Testament, in Greek, it's Jesus. And you remember what that name means? It simply means God saves. Right? How appropriate. Jesus, our Savior, his name means God saves. But what about God's name? What does God's name signify? When God reveals his name, he's revealing something very important about himself. And in the Bible, there are many places where God reveals his name to human beings. And some of them are names, what he designates himself by. Some of them are adjectives, what describes his name. And so for the next several weeks, God willing, Pastor LD and I will switch off and talk about these specific names of God. But today we will cover perhaps the most important name of them all, most foundational, most basic name that describes God perhaps the best. And that is from the passage that we just read. And that is the name Yahweh. Yahweh. And it's spelled YHWH. In Hebrew, it's just four letters, YHWH. There's no vowel in it. And so people didn't know how to pronounce it. How do you pronounce just the consonants? And so they put vowels, and now they say they will pronounce it Yahweh, or better known as Jehovah. An English translation or English pronunciation of Yahweh would be Jehovah. Well, what does it mean? Well, we don't have to conjecture. God tells us what it means. It says, I am that I am. I am has sent you. Moses asked him, what is your name, God? And he says, I am that I am. I am. Well, how do I say it? Yahweh. Yahweh is my name. Now, if you read NIV translation, New International Version, or the ESV, English Standard Version, then, or even maybe King James, whenever you see the Lord, the word Lord in it, referring to God, but they're all capitalized, Its actually transliteration is Yahweh. In the original language, it's YHWH. They simply don't know how to translate it, so they will say Lord, but it's in all caps. So whenever you see that, it's referring to this particular name of God that he revealed to Moses. So what does it mean, I am that I am? I am Yahweh. What does it mean? One commentator puts it this way. I am being that I am being. Is that better? I am the ising, I-S, ising one. That is, the one who always is. So what's being emphasized is that God is not a conceptual being. He's not an abstract identity out there, but he's an active one. He is always acting. He is there. He is present. And the reply that he gives to Moses implies that it's inappropriate to refer to God as somebody who was in the past or even somebody who will be in the future, but somebody who is always present. C.S. Lewis has a brilliant description of this. He says, you know, time doesn't exist for God. So for us, it's past, present, future, right? To Marty from Back to the Future, right, 30 years ago, we are living in the future, right, 2015. That's the past. That's 30 years ago. Now this is a present, and they're trying to make a prediction on what it will be like 30 years from now. We don't know. In 2045, what will it be like? We can conjecture, but we are not for sure. But that's how we human beings are. But to God, all of it is happening at the same time. Past, present, future, time does not matter to him. And so God is always there in the past, in the present, in the future. God is active in that way. Okay? He always is. He is a self-existing one. He is not caused by anything. A philosopher will refer to him as the uncaused cause. He's not caused by anything. Nothing brought him about, but he causes everything else. And we'll talk a little more about that. So having given that background, and still it's fuzzy, right? Okay, what does that mean? And it should be fuzzy, because we are trying to understand the concept of God. But let's come up with some implications. And there are five implications that I want to share with you. There are so much more, but at least five, so that we can get a little better grasp of who this God is. This I am that I am, this Jehovah, the self-existent one. What does it mean? Number one, he exists. His name implies that God exists. He is there. God makes it known to Moses that he is there and he is about to make himself known to the Israelites, whom he has chosen. And also, he's also going to make himself known to the Egyptians, the enemies as well. Remember, he sends out plagues after plagues, 10 plagues, to make sure that the Israelites and Egyptians know that he is the only God, because he was really destroying Egyptians' 10 gods. The river god, send them frogs, right? Gnats, right? The nature god, send them. Block the sun. You worship the sun god? Well, let me block it off too. And so one by one, God is demonstrating to the people that he is there, that he exists. And so that's what it means, first of all. Now, when I was younger and I was a lot more brash and I really thought that I was smarter than I really was, and so I used to stump up the Christians when I wasn't a Christian by saying, well, if God exists, why can't we see him? Wouldn't it be easy for him to simply show himself physically to us and let us know that he exists so that none of us will ever have to doubt and we don't have to have this debate whether God exists or not? All he's got to do is show up, right? Well, God did show up. He is the father of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he showed up to all of them. And he also showed up in the most dramatic way in the person of Jesus Christ. But how do we know that those people existed? How do you know if those stories are true? How do you know some men did not sit down and write all the stories up? Most nations have a beginning story as fantastical as that. Well, we know they are true the same way we know that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson are the first presidents of the United States of America. How do we know that they were there? Have you ever seen George Washington in person? How do you know Lincoln is the one who abolished slavery? Historicity, right? We go back and then we go we look at the history, we look at the evidence, we look at the people around it, and we look at how trustable they are, so on and so forth. And then we go, yeah, you know, that happened, even though I wasn't there. I can never verify it scientifically, but historically, we know that it happened. Same way. Christianity, unlike other religions, puts premium on evidence and historicity. And today's sermon, frankly, is too narrow a scope to get in more about why God exists rather than he doesn't. So we are not going to go too deep into that. But God is there, his name means, and God has always been there. Without him, nothing exists. He is the ground of being. If God didn't exist, you and I wouldn't exist, and thus you and I wouldn't know that we didn't exist, because there would be nothing without God. Can you picture nothing? Let's think about the concept of nothing. Try to picture nothing. What does nothing look like to you? Are you picturing a dark void? Are you picturing empty space? Guess what? That's not nothing. That's still space. That's still darkness. That's something. That's not nothing. You cannot picture nothingness. But before God, there was nothing. There was no space. There was no time before God. God is the absolute ground of being. He is the one not only who created space, but he is the one who also started time. So we have this funny episode. How many of you have this had this episode with your children, or maybe you went through this with when you're a child? A child asks, "Mommy, where did I come from?" "Well, you came from me." "Well, Mommy, where did you come from?" "Oh, well, I came from my mommy, your grandma." "Well, where did grandma come from?" "Well, she came from her grandma, or her mother, your great-grandma." "Well, where did great-grandma come from?" Right? It goes on and on and on. 10 minutes later, right, what are you saying? "Well, she came from great-great-great-grandma." And then she goes, "Where did that great-great-grandma come from?" All right, you go, "Adam and Eve." And the child asks, "What?" "Well, where did Adam and Eve come from?" And you say, "God." And then the child goes, "Where did God come from?" And at that point, you're so tempted to say, "Well, God came from God's mommy." But that won't work, because once you went down that road, then it's going to go, "Well, where did God's mommy come from?" "Well, God's grandma." It goes on forever. Right? So you stop there, came from God, and that's that. And you cannot answer the question, where did God come from? Now, I remember asking that very question to my mom, actually. I must have been maybe 5 or 6 years old, and I don't remember exactly what she said when she said, "Well, we came from God," when I asked her, "Where did God come from?" I think she got just annoyed and told me to just go off and ask, you know, ask Daddy, or find it out on your own, or what have you. But where do we go from there as adults? How do we answer the question, "Where did God come from?" Ever thought about that deeply? I have. I have an engineering mind, and so I gotta look into these things, right? Don't believe just because, well, a whole bunch of other people believe. Think through things. Where did God come from? Think about that question. Where did God come from? What are you assuming? What are you presupposing? You're presupposing that God came from somewhere. In other words, somewhere, a place existed before God. And whatever that place existed produced God, and God came from that place. What you are presupposing, what you're assuming, is that a place was there before God, a place precedes God. But the definition of God is that no. God did not come from anywhere. Somewhere came from God. Everywhere came from God, because before God, there was nothing, there was no space. And I cannot even say what was there before God, because whenever I say what was there before, what am I presupposing once again? Time. Time must have been there before God. But we are saying, no. Time didn't even exist before God. God is the one who said to time, "Time, I want you to start now." And time existed. So none of what we think as human beings, we always think in terms of space and time, applies to God. It's like I was explaining to my trick students, the difference between one dimension, which is a line, two dimension, you know, which is plane, and then three dimension, which is what the world we're living in. And they said, "What does four dimension look like?" Like, they told me to draw it on the board, four dimension. Like, stupidity of the juniors and seniors in high school these days. Like, how do you draw? If I can draw it in two dimension to four dimension, I mean, I would be God. I can't even imagine it. You can't imagine it, because we cannot get out of the third dimension. So God is like that. It's not something that we can... I basically lost all of you right there, huh? But, okay, well, never mind, all right? So, sorry, I just had to go there. But anyway, God is infinite. He has always been there, even before space and time. We cannot regress infinitely. Philosophically, it's impossible. And I said that God said to time one day, start. And you know, God's going to say one day to time, stop. And you know what will happen? When time stops, guess what? We will stop aging. Amen. We'll talk more about that, why that is true. Okay? So hold that thought. So, God exists. Number two, I am that I am Yahweh means that He is the absolute reality. He is the absolute reality. God is the ground of being, which means He is the one who determines what is right and what is wrong. You know, this is something that most Americans these days don't like, that God determines, something other than ourselves determines what is right and what is wrong. See, we human beings are not the ground of being. Therefore, we don't determine right and wrong. People say this all the time, and somebody talked to me last week, and she was basically saying, quoting somebody else who said to her, well, what's right for you is right for you. What's right for me is right for me. If it's right for you, it might be wrong for me, but it's okay. You do what you feel is right, and I'll do what I feel is right. Because right and wrong is what? It's all relative. There is nothing that is absolute. Everything is all relative. It's all what you believe. You know, I find it very interesting that we don't believe that about the money that we have in our bank account. Imagine you went to your bank, and you went to the teller, and you wanted to withdraw some money from your bank. And the teller tells you that, I'm sorry, but your balance is zero. You have no money in this bank. You withdrew it all last time. But you tell the teller that, you know what? That's what you believe. I believe I have $1 million in my bank. And so, give it to me right now or else. Now, what do you think the teller will do? We'll probably push that little red button. Police will come and will take you away to a mental asylum or a jail, right? And once you're sitting in your jail cell, you can believe all you want. You know what? I believe I am in an uninhabited island all by myself, and servants in uniform bring me free breakfast and free dinner. Whereas, you know, there are guards, you know, feeding you, right? So that you don't die in the jail cell. You can believe all you want that that's where you are, but that does not change the fact or the reality that you are sitting in jail cell. So reality does not change depending on what we believe. But why are we so foolish to believe in something like that? Why are we, the most educated people in the world, Americans, why do we believe what is true for you is true for you, but what is true for me is true for me? Everything is relative, and so whatever we believe becomes reality. Why do we believe that? Why do we buy into that Matrix movie and what they, you know, present, you know, hook, line, and sinker? You know why? Here's why. And here's what we do, okay? And I might be stepping a lot of foot here because we are Americans, right? And we have bought into this. It's this that we have bought into. Let's bend reality to fit our inner desires. That's the American culture. Let's change what seems to be the reality so that it really fits what we desire. It's what I believe that matters, and if I believe it enough, I can change the reality. So, for example, you're born a boy or a girl, but you don't happen to like your gender. And so you're going to believe, I should have been born a boy when you're a girl, for example, or a girl when you're a boy. And so I'm going to change the external reality to fit my inner desire, because that is the ultimate reality, right? What I feel, what I desire is the ultimate reality. And so whatever this external thing is, I'm going to change that. Now, hypocrisy is that when a black person, right, born black, thinking that, you know what, I should have been born a white person, so I'm going to change my skin color. We don't tolerate that, but when it's gender, we tolerate it. The hypocrisy of it all, right? We can't have it both ways. It's like a child wanting the cake and wanting to eat it too. Like, once you eat it, it's not there, so you can't have it, right? She cries, but I want it! But I want to eat it too. How can I have it both ways? You can't, child. Because we are not the ultimate reality. God is. He is the ultimate reality. He decides what is right and wrong for our own good. And he tells us, live inside of it. Change your belief to match up with the ultimate reality. Not change the ultimate reality or try to change the ultimate reality to fit your desire. And you know where that comes from? Let me tell you. It sounds all new. Everything is relative. It's what you make of it. It's what you believe that's important. It doesn't matter what reality is. That's as old as humanity itself. Adam and Eve, original sin. That was the very essence of the original sin. When Satan came to Adam and Eve and says, well, did God really say? Why do you believe him? Right? I know he said what he said, but you be in charge of your own life. You determine for yourself what is right and wrong. It's okay if you think that, right? If you truly believe that, doesn't matter. And Adam and Eve thought, wow, that makes sense. Why should God be in charge? I will be in charge. I'll determine what is right and wrong. And if I say eating this fruit is not wrong, then it's not wrong. And so cursed humanity for all eternity, right, until Jesus comes. And has the world been a better place? Because we have made ourselves the ground being, ultimate reality? No. Why do we fight? Why do we go to war? Isn't it because it's my culture against your culture? It's my way against your way? Right? You know, people talk about Christians being narrow-minded, and the most narrow-minded people are the ones that are accusing us of being narrow-minded. We have to believe the way they do, or we are narrow-minded. I'm sorry, isn't that the very definition of being narrow-minded? Right? Anyway, God exists, and he also is the absolute reality. God is, not us or what we believe. Number three, I am that I am also means his presence. God's presence. One commentator puts it this way. The name Yahweh, defined in terms of active being or presence, is the name by which God is to be known henceforth forever. It is to be his remembrance, literally that which is to make his presence a reality to the generations to come. So I am that I am. I am showing yourself. I am telling you my name. God is saying, I am present with you. I am with you. Now, this was really important to Moses and the Israelites because to their eyes, God had been absent for 400 years. Remember Joseph and his brothers and so on? They took all of the brothers into, father and mother and brother, into the land of Egypt because that's where food was, and everywhere else was a famine. And they happened to live there for 400 years until Egyptians grew threatened of them and enslaved them. And so think about Israelites living in foreign land for 400 years, and now they're slaves to these Egyptian masters. What will they be thinking? I've heard stories many, many years ago that our God defeated the Egyptian gods, took us out, and was going to give us a promised land. But it's been 400 years, and there's no sign of God, no prophet, no word of God. Where is God? All these fantastical stories that I've heard, I mean, was that just a nice story? Like a nursery rhyme to make us feel good about ourselves, but really, we're just slaves. Where is God? If we are God's people, then how can we become slaves and stay slaves to these Egyptians? In the midst of that, God shows up to Moses, picks one man, and decides that he's going to show them that not only is he there with them now, but he actually has been there with them all along, that God's presence actually never left. I'll prove it to you. You know, but this is a very important lesson for us. Application. Just because we do not feel God's presence doesn't mean that God is absent. Just because you don't feel God's presence in your life does not mean that God is absent. God is still there. Think of Moses. You've seen the Prince of Egypt, right, young people? He was born was a Hebrew boy. His mother floated him down the river because they were killing all the Jewish babies. Who picks him up? Egyptian princess. Pharaoh's daughter picks him up from the river while bathing, takes him home, makes him his son, raises him in the palace until he's older, and then he kills an Egyptian because he knows that he is a Hebrew, and he hated this Egyptian who was messing with another Hebrew, kills him, runs for his life, and where does he go? He goes to the desert, and he lives there in the desert for 40 years. So he was born, grew up in the palace, he goes to the desert, lives in the desert for 40 years, and when he's 80 years old, that's when he meets God, a burning bush. Okay, he was not a young man, he was 80-year-old old man, and God speaks to him, and then Moses goes, well, you want me to go talk to my people? How long will they believe me? What is your name? And then that's when God says, I am that I am. I am has sent you. Yahweh is my name. Right? What is God doing at 80 years old? And you might think that, you know what? God didn't show up in Moses' life until he was 80 years old. He was absent during all those years. But if you remember, right, where does God send Moses to? He sends now this 80-year-old man back to the palace to see Pharaoh. Who better to talk to Pharaoh than somebody who grew up in that environment? He knows all about Pharaoh, how they work, right? And then once he got the Israelites out of Egypt, he goes where? To the desert. And how long does he stay there? 40 years. He knows all about that because he has spent his last 40 years from age 40 to 80 in the desert. Now he's having to spend another 40 years with the Israelites in the desert. Why do you think God did that? Because he knew exactly what he wanted to do with Moses from the time that he was born. I was going to send him back to Pharaoh, get him out, and he's going to be in the desert for 40 years. I am training you, Moses, all your life for 80 years. You thought I was absent. You thought I wasn't there, but I have been there all along. I was present with you. So whenever you thought, where is God? Why is God not answering my prayer? I don't see him. I don't experience him. He's not answering my prayer. The whole time he might have been training you for something that could happen when you're 80 years old. God is present. Jesus promised, and God himself, the Father, promised, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Never, never. I'll never leave you nor will I forsake you. His presence is with us. He is with you whether you feel his presence or not. Talk to him in prayer. Listen to him through his word. He is there. From morning when you wake up till evening when you sleep, and even while you're sleeping. And you get up in the middle of the night, something startled you. Maybe it was God. Talk to him. Listen to him. God's presence. Fourthly, let's quickly move on. I am that I am. Yahweh, what does that mean? What implication? He doesn't change. That's another implication. God does not change. He is timeless, which means he won't change. Have you realized the relationship between time and change? How do you measure time? Have you ever thought about it? I know we look at our clock, right? But I mean, clock is man's invention. We made this thing, right, to kind of keep a, you know, tab on time. But how do you know? If we didn't have any watches, how would you know that time has passed? You know what you look at? You look at the change. For example, let's say you went back to your old neighborhood that you haven't been there for 15 years or 10 years or for me like 20 years. Let's say I went back to Virginia where I grew up. And then I look at the surroundings and it's exactly as I remember it. It hasn't gotten older. Houses are all there, the grass and tree, it's exactly as I remember it. What's more amazing is that as I see these kids in the neighborhood that I grew up in playing, they are the exact same kids as 20 years ago. No, they are not the sons and daughters of the kids that I used to play with, so they look like them, but they are the exact same kids. They look at me and go, whoa, what happened to you? We're still kids, but you look old. Right? So think of this imaginary thing, right? Can't happen in real life, but a Twilight Zone type of thing, right? You go there and it's like, just like, what are you thinking at that point? You're thinking, time hasn't changed for you guys, right? Time stood still for you guys because nothing what? Nothing changed. How do you know time has elapsed when something changes? my girls, when they were babies, and I look at their pictures, and now they're old, right? I go, wow, look at how much time has passed. Right? When I look at my 10 years ago, I had like full head of hair. Then I look at my picture, you know, when I'm like at the mall, like I glance at it, it's like, what is that old man doing? You know, and then it's like me, I go, wow, time has passed. 10 years have gone by, 15 years have gone by, right? Time means change. God is outside and beyond time. So God doesn't change. And he's perfect, so he doesn't need to change. So when now, does it make sense to you when God says, time, stop, eternity, right? We don't change. We'll be young forever, forever young. which is an awesome thing. Young people don't know that, but it's a good thing. Trust me, right? And you know what else that means? God doesn't change means that God will always be the type of father that Jesus described in the prodigal son story. Some of you who were here, when I was describing to you this father, the prodigal son's father, when the idiot of a son came back after living a licentious life and father doesn't care and then comes and hugs and kisses and just accepts him back. I mean, wasn't your heart just thrilled with the excitement that we have a father, heavenly father, that will accept us no matter what we have done? Just at the sight of our face, he comes and he kisses and hugs and doesn't even ask how we have spent his money? Guess what? That same father is still the father, same father that we have today because God does not change. That's what it means. That's the implication. When we finally go home and then we have our heads low and God, man, I really should have lived a better life. Oh, man, I messed up my life. And then Father comes and hugs and kisses you and you are home. That's all that matters. You're my son. You're my daughter. Here's heaven. It's yours. Here's earth. That's yours. God doesn't change. What an awesome thing it is. He's not going to give us a cold shoulder. Yeah, you know, Jesus thought that was 2,000 years ago. Now, no. No. God does not change. Lastly, I am that I am means that he is to be distinguished from other gods. He is not one among many gods. And he is not even the best among many gods. He is the only one. He is the only true God. There is no other God. Isaiah 45, verses 5 and 6 say this, I am the Lord and there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. I equip you, though you do not know me, that people may know me from the rising of the sun and from the west, and there is none besides me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. You've heard this said in the Northwest area many times. All gods are basically the same, I think. They're just called by different names, by different religions, right? Jehovah, Allah, Jesus, Krishna, Buddha. I mean, different names, but really, they're all basically referring to the same God. So they say. You know, that would be like my girls, when they're old enough to marry, asking somebody else to walk them down the aisle as their daddy. And then when I ask them, wait a minute, why didn't you ask me, girls, to walk you down the aisle? I'm your daddy, right? Literally, I'm your daddy. And they said, well, I mean, daddy's a dad. Does it matter? It has to be you. You know, so I asked somebody else's dad. He's a daddy. So he walked me down the aisle. Would it matter? Yeah, it would matter. They're my daughters. You should ask your daddy, not somebody else's daddy, to walk you down the aisle. It absolutely matters, right? So does it matter? Well, it doesn't matter if this is God, Jehovah, you know, whatever, Allah. You know, it's all just names. As long as it's God that we are praying to and relying on, then we're all going to go to the same place. No. There is only one God. But, Pastor, I thought that you said there's no other God besides a Christian God. So why is God worried that we will worship other gods? Because commandment number 2 says, you shall have no other gods before me. But if there's no other God, how can we worship something that doesn't exist, right? You're saying there's only one God, but you also tell us you should not worship other gods. Like, are you telling us there are other gods? I thought you just said there's no other God. How can we worship something that... All right, so here's the thing. There is no other God. There is no other sovereign. There is no ultimate reality other than just one God. However, we will create or we will worship as God, worship as ultimate reality, or worship as something that gives us the greatest value in our lives, whether it's a person or a thing, and we'll treat that thing or person as God in our lives, as the ultimate reality, as something that gives us the ultimate value. That, the true God says, that's your God. It's not a real God. And therein lies the truth. Because they're not real gods, whether it's a relationship, right? Whether it's success, whether it's money, whether it's family, whether it's your children, whatever that you treat as your God, the ultimate reality, something that gives you your value, will not come through for you because they're not the true God. There is only one God, and that is the Yahweh, the Jehovah God who said, I am that I am. And so whatever we put our value into, worship as God will disappoint us in the end. Has to. Because they're not God, but we treat them as gods. Of course they will disappoint. Of course they will fall short. Right? Those of us who are older, we know this. Right? I'm sorry to break the hearts of young parents with young kids. You know, they're beautiful when they're 2, 4, 7, maybe even 9. But they're getting to be that age, you go, oh, I don't know, you know. Like, I thought they were cute, but now, right? They will disappoint. There's only one God, and that is Yahweh, the God of the Bible. Conclusion. There is a person in the New Testament who dared to use the same name, I Am, for himself. Can you believe it? This name was so reverenced among the Israelites that they would not even say the word Yahweh. They would write the letter, they would write the word Lord, Adonai, in place of Yahweh because they were so afraid of offending this holy name of God. But there was a person, a rabbi in the New Testament who dared to say that I am that I am. I am Yahweh that I am. Who did that? Jesus did. Jesus used that name for himself. When the Pharisees were picking fights with him, he tells them this. This is the most stunning statement made by anyone. Your father, Jesus said, Abraham, rejoiced that he would see my day. Wait a minute. Abraham saw your day, Jesus? They're thinking. But Abraham existed 2,000 years ago. And you're 30 years old. You're telling me like you were there, that Abraham saw you? That's exactly what the Pharisees ask. So the Jews said to him, you are not yet 50 years old, and you have seen Abraham? And listen to what Jesus said. He said, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. Before Abraham was, I am. And Janet, the English teacher, will tell you that's grammatically wrong. He should have said, before Abraham was, I was. Not I am. He's saying I am for a specific reason. Why? Because it's a name. It's a name of God. In the Old Testament, he is saying, I am, I have always been. Not I was, but I am. I'm an active being. I'm the ultimate reality. I'm the ever-present help in need. I am the Jehovah God. Who created you, who is making your heart beat at this moment and your mouth spit so that you can speak those words. I am that God. Before Abraham was, whom you venerate as your father, I was even before him, I precede him because I created him. That I am is with you. And several weeks later, what happened to that I am, the great Jehovah God, crucified. Nailed by the hands and the hearts and the brain that he created, died for us, you, me, the world. So don't sell yourself short, people, by trying to boost up your self-esteem by looking younger or earning more. You are worth more than all of the planets and galaxies in the universe put together. You're worth the life of the very God of very God, the Son of God in Jesus Christ. Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, temple of God within you, whom you have from God? You're not your own. You're bought with a price. So glorify God in your body. That very God resides in you, lives in you. That's you. That's you. That's me. Let's act like it. Let's pray.